I'll remind you this morning that we are in the middle of a sermon series that's built on a very simple idea that faith is not simply a set of beliefs, it is also a practice. That faith is always intended to be lived out in the context of our lives. And so what we've been doing for a couple weeks now is we're looking at seven ancient practices, things that the people of God have been doing century after century, practices that we believe, and hear the really important qualification here, practices, if done with the right heart, are practices that can help us become closer to God and experience, well, I'll borrow Dallas Willard's language, the renovation of the heart that God desires to do with us. And we began with, well, the two hardest of the seven. And so, good news, it's all downhill from here. If you got through the first 2 weeks, you guys are going to be fine. We began by talking about fasting and tithing. And I'll be honest, the response that I've gotten from you has been profoundly encouraging. Because some of you have taken up the practice of fasting. Some of you have made the commitment to begin working towards that full tithe. And so that's really encouraging to me. Thank you for that. This morning, we're going to talk about feasting. And I will apologize to you because I probably got things a little out of order. We probably should have started with this, with the sacred meal, because when you understand why it's important, then fasting makes a lot more sense. So I'm just going to trust that you can work backwards and connect all of the dots. We're going to talk about the sacred meal, about feasting, and I don't know if you know this, but food is really important in our faith. Did you know this? That food and meals and sharing meals around the table, these are sacred things. And it's very easy to miss this because, let's be honest, eating is a pretty common, mundane thing, isn't it? We're eating meals three times, some of us maybe four times, in high school and college five, three times a day. We're eating meals, and it is just so regular and so ordinary. How could something so common also be sacred, also be special? But have you ever stopped and wondered, what exactly are we doing when we're eating? Like, what is this eating thing all about, and what does it mean? Judging by your look, you're wondering, what is Pastor doing in his office during the week that's letting him think up these questions? We know what eating is. It's eating, right? But have you ever thought about it? When we eat, we take something that is outside of ourselves. We're taking something that belongs to the created world that God made. It's not me, and I take it, and it becomes me. And it becomes my life. That's kind of a wild thought, isn't it? That something outside of me can be put in me, and my body converts it into me. It's like the protein, and the fiber, and the fat, and the vitamins, and the minerals, and the amino acids and all, it goes into me, it becomes me, and it becomes the energy that I live my life with. It might be pretty ordinary, but that kind of sounds cool to me. What that tells us about human nature is that, well, our existence is always contingent. It's always dependent on what is outside of me, that my life in me is not self-sustaining. I always need something outside to come inside for my life to continue. And when we remember that everything is made by a good creator, it's a reminder that, well, my life is always dependent on him. and his good gifts and his blessings. My life is always contingent. And so when we think about eating that way, all of a sudden I think it becomes much more apparent why we see it as a sacred thing. Why eating and meals take on religious significance. And what I'll tell you, I hope you've noticed this, maybe you never have. You cannot tell the story of God without talking about the food. Have you ever noticed that? You cannot tell the story of God in Scripture without talking about the food. Can I tell it to you? Begins at the beginning, right? Creation. God makes this amazing world and then he plants a garden. And God puts man and woman in the garden and he gives them the task of stewarding it and caring for it. They're the image bearers, made in the image of God. They look a lot like him, and so they represent him in this garden, in this world, and they're given care over all of it. And there's really only one prohibition that God gives them, if we can even call it that, and it has to do with food. He says, look, all of these trees and all of the stuff in the garden, oh, it's good for you. Seek your life here. But there is one tree, and you must not eat of that tree. Or to say it another way, if you go seeking your life there, because that's what we're doing when we're eating, we're taking something outside of us, putting it in us, it becomes our life. If you seek your life there, what you'll actually find is death. All the rest, seek your life there. I've given it to you. It's good. Not here. You'll only find death. You must trust me on this. And humanity, we didn't trust him on it. And we went off trying to establish our own life outside of the parameters of God, and the result was that Adam and Eve were kicked out of the garden. We call this the fall, but the fall wasn't just what happened to Adam and Eve and the rest of humanity that would follow. It's everything under their stewardship. All of creation fell with them. And so now, well, it says that man will get his bread, his food, by the sweat of his brow. Now he has to fight the earth. He plants good seed, but weeds come up too. That's how we get food now. And so God has a problem. It's not just that man and woman rebelled, they did, but now all of his creation has fallen into death. And so God sets out to redeem all of it, to fix all of it, to deal with the problem of sin and death. And the plan he comes up with begins with one man, a man named Abram, whose name will be changed to Abraham, for he will be the father of many nations. And when you read the story, maybe you notice that a lot of these stories involve important meals. Like the time where Abraham's nephew Lot is captured by raiders, and Abraham gets a band of guys together, and they go raid the raiders, and they bring Lot back and all his stuff and the women and the children and the flocks and the herds and the property. And he has this interesting encounter with a priest king named Melchizedek. Now, understand, the early church fathers loved the story. You'll hear about it in the book of Hebrews in the New Testament because they were looking back at the Old Testament and looking for what we call typological examples of Christ. They were saying, where do we see Jesus showing up in the Old Testament story? And they loved this one because he's a priest king. Kind of like Jesus, and his name is Melchizedek. Mel is the Hebrew word for king. Zedek is the Hebrew word for righteousness, king of righteousness. And what does this king of righteousness do when Abraham shows up? He gets out bread and wine. That's interesting. Now, you would have heard the story if you had read the passages on the back of the card last week, because not only is this about a sacred meal, but then Abraham takes a tenth, a tithe of all the plunder, and gives it to the priest king. But it's not even the best meal story we get with Abraham. It comes a little later in the story. Abraham, well, he's old. Like old, like older than anybody in this room by a lot of years. He's old. And his wife is old. And God has promised that he would be the father of many nations, but that hasn't been working out, and he's not sure how it's going to work out. And one day, he's sitting outside his tent, heat of the days, getting some shade by the door, and it says Yahweh appeared to him. Now, this isn't the first time that Yahweh has appeared to him, but it does seem to be the first time that Yahweh appears as three men. Your early church fathers loved that too because they pointed to that, like, that's the Trinity right there. So the three men who are the one God show up, and Abraham seems to recognize Yahweh. Even though he's never shown up this way before, he recognizes him, and he jumps up and he runs up and he bows to the ground. He says, please come eat with me. And they agree, and he runs into the tent. He says, quick, get the best of the flour, the best of it, and make cakes. And he goes out and he finds the fattened calf, the one they've been saving for a celebration, and he prepares it, and Abraham serves a meal to God. And at this meal, this is where God says, you're going to have a son. And the son will be born of your wife, who is impossibly old, she will have a child. And the promise I have made to you will be fulfilled through him. It's at this meal that Abraham serves God that the promise of Isaac is made. And we begin to discover very early in the story that, well, you probably know this is true in your own life. Really important things happen around tables and at meals. It's not the last meal story in the book of Genesis. We get one at the end. By this time in the story, Abraham has had Isaac. Isaac has had Jacob. Jacob's name has been changed to Israel. Israel's had 12 sons, the 12 tribes of Israel. And the end of Genesis explains to us how the people of Israel ended up in slavery in Egypt. Kind of ironically, it's because they sold their brother into slavery into Egypt. It's the story of Joseph. Though when the brothers come to Egypt to buy grain during a famine, he's not a slave anymore. He's the number two guy. He's right under Pharaoh. He recognizes them. They don't recognize him. What does he decide to do? Let's have a party. He has a feast. The book of Exodus picks up a little bit later. The people have been there. Tells us they've all been enslaved, and it begins to tell us the great story of God's salvation. And there are really two high water marks in that story. The first one is the Passover. It's the 10th plague that God was going to use to break the will of Pharaoh and of Egypt. They take a lamb and they sacrifice it. They take the blood, they put it on their door so that the angel will pass over. And then they have a meal together. And this meal is to become a memorial forever, so that they would never forget the salvation of their God. Salvation comes with a meal attached. Of course, they immediately go off into the wilderness. They've been set free, and one of the first questions in the wilderness is, what in the world are we going to eat? Well, you're going to eat manna. What's that? Well, that's what the word means. What's that? It's bread from heaven. You're going to eat quail that God will blow into the camp with a wind. You will drink water that God will cause to squirt from a rock. God provides everything they need. Moses leads them to Mount Sinai, where they will make covenant. This is a different covenant than the one made with Abraham, but it's a continuation of it. It's all of the people agreeing that God's going to be their God, and they're not going to worship any other gods. And Moses says, what do you all think? Is this a good idea? And they say, yes, this is a good deal. We want to covenant with God. And when they agree to it and they go through the covenant ceremony, this is what happens. Exodus 24. Then Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and the 70 elders of Israel went up, and they saw the God of Israel. There was under his feet, as it were, a pavement of sapphire stone like the very heaven for clearness, and he did not lay his hand on the chief men of the people of Israel. Normally, when you see God, you die. But this is an exception. He did not lay his hand on the chief men of Israel. They beheld God and ate and drank. What is it about showing up in the presence of God and the natural response is like, well, let's eat. God shows up to Abraham. He's like, great, we're going to have a meal. The elders see God and they're like, well, we should probably eat something, right? So they have what seems to be a covenant feast. They eat and drink in the presence of God. I don't know. Food seems to be really important in these stories. But did you notice the description you get of God? This has always perplexed me. When they describe the Lord, they say this. There was under his feet, as it were, a pavement of sapphire. I mean, you're not talking about God, you're talking about the pavement. And I've always wondered, why would you do that? If you had seen God, why wouldn't you give a better description of him? You talked about his feet, so he's got some feet, but like, I'd like some more details. Why wouldn't you give them? I've pondered this for quite a while, and this is the conclusion I've come to, I think. So that there would be no temptation for what follows. That there would never be a written description of what God looked like so that you'd never be tempted to make an image of him. Because this is what happens in Exodus chapter 32. They have the covenant meal, and then Moses goes up on the mountain to receive the law of God. He's up there 40 days. The people get bored. When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, "Up, make us gods who shall go before us. As for this Moses, this man who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." And Aaron received the gold from their hands, and he fashioned it with a graving tool and made a golden calf. And they said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." And they rose up early the next day, offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. Meals seem to have a lot of significance one way or the other in the story. If you read through the law that Moses gave to the people of Israel, you discover very quickly that a whole lot of it has to do with what you can eat and what you can't eat and how you're supposed to eat it and when you're supposed to eat it. We talked last week about tithing. We read a number of Old Testament passages out of the book of Deuteronomy, which is a part of the law. But I have to confess to you, I didn't tell you everything. He's like, what? If you read through the Old Testament, and in the law in particular, you discover that there was not one tithe. There were three. I only told you about the one. The tithe we talked about last week is that 10%, first 10% gathered every year, taken to the place where the Lord causes his name to dwell. So think tabernacle and then the temple after that. That was the first tithe. There was another tithe that was only collected every 3 years. Not every year, every 3 years. And that tithe was not taken to the central place of worship. That tithe stayed local. And that tithe did a couple things. One, it took care of the Levites. You remember the Levites were a tribe that didn't get any land because they lived amongst all the other tribes. They were the religious, spiritual caretakers of all of Israel. They were the priestly clan. And so because they did not have a land inheritance, they had no other means of income, this took care of them. And then also, this money was used to provide for the poor locally. For the widows, for the orphans, for the infirmed. This was how we took care of the community. That's the second tithe. But then there was a third one. And like the first one, it's 10% and it's every year. But you know what it was for? For celebrations. God told his people to set aside 10% of their income every year so that they could have parties, that they could celebrate Passover, and not celebrate it a little, celebrate it a lot. I mean, really celebrate the things that God had done. So what you need to know this morning is if you really want a Old Testament biblical budget, you need to plan on setting 10% of your budget aside to have a really good time at the holy days of the year. Amen? Should we start this? I'll let you think about that one. The rest of the Old Testament is full of eating stories. You can think about the prophets. You can think about Elijah and the miracle with the widow at Zarephath, where in the middle of a drought and a famine, this jar of oil and this jar of flour, they never run out. They keep going back to them again and again, and they're just making bread and break. Never runs out. You can think of in the exilic period, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, captured, taken to Babylon to serve in the court. They're given the king's food, but it violates their dietary code. And they say, no, just give us fruit and vegetables. And God honors them for how they handled themselves with what they ate. You can think of the story of Esther when she's made queen to the king of the Persian Empire, and the Jewish people are being threatened, and she has to do something. How does she save them? She throws a banquet for the king. Food's really important in our story. This continues right into the New Testament, especially with Jesus. Is it an accident that his first miracle is turning water into wine at a wedding party? That some of his most public miracles are the feeding of the 5,000, feeding of the 4,000, the multiplying of bread and of fish. It's such a good miracle, he's got to have an encore. He doesn't do it once, he does it twice. And then there's the Last Supper, which, remember, happens at Passover. That's not an accident. That at this moment when the people of Israel both remember salvation and celebrate it in the Exodus, Jesus comes to this table because important things happen around a table with his disciples, and he brings new meaning into it. He's pre-interpreting his sacrifice for them and telling his church, do this in remembrance of me. But it doesn't end there. Like you would think, okay, the story brought us to communion, that's as good as it gets, but it just keeps going, doesn't it? Like, have you read all the post-resurrection stories? I'm pretty sure most of them involve food. Like, the Mark's gospel doesn't really give us any post-resurrection stories. So we're down to three gospels, and almost all of them involve food somehow. So you get Luke chapter 24. Jesus is meeting with people on the road to Emmaus. They don't recognize him. And he's going along and he's explaining what has happened to them. And he acts like he's going to keep going down the road. They say, no, no, it's too late. Come in, eat with us. He does. And when he was at table with them, hear the language. He took bread. He blessed it. He broke it. And he gave it to them. And their eyes were opened and they recognized him and he vanished from their sight. And then they said to each other, did not our hearts burn within us as he talked on the road while he opened to us the scriptures? Don't you wish those guys had written that down? Like, couldn't you have just jotted down some notes about how Jesus explained the entire Old Testament to you? Like, that would have been handy. They didn't do it. Did not our hearts burn within us while he talked to us on the road, while he opened to us the scriptures? And they rose that same hour, returned to Jerusalem, and they found the 11 and those who were with him gathered together, saying, the Lord has indeed risen and has appeared to Simon. And then they told him what happened on the road and how he was known to them in the breaking of the bread. In the breaking of the bread, we get to know him. And then you get another story where all of the disciples are huddled together in a room. They're afraid, and the door's locked, and all of a sudden Jesus appears, and we don't know where he came from, but here he is, and they're freaking out. They're like, is this a ghost of Jesus? What is this? And Jesus says, hey, boys, I'm hungry. You got anything to eat? Because let's be honest, if you've been dead for 3 days, you'd probably be hungry too. So they bring him a fish, and they're just like sitting there watching Jesus eat this fish. And then there's John's gospel. And John tells us about the disciples, how many of them went back to Galilee, and they go back to fishing, and they seem to be returning to some of the things they had been doing before, and Jesus shows up, and you get another one of these repeated miracles. It's different this time, though. You hear it first when Peter is called. It's that miraculous catch of fish, and now he's back to fishing, and they haven't caught anything all night, so Jesus shouts out, try the other side of the boat, because that's what you want to tell a fisherman who's not catching anything, right? Like, but they do, and they have this miraculous catch, and then they come in, and, well, Jesus has breakfast waiting for them on the beach. And even though he's got breakfast and it's already ready, he says, hey, I see you caught some fish. Bring some along. We'll cook those too. And then Peter is restored to Jesus. Three times Peter denied him. Three times Jesus says, Peter, do you love me? Really important things happen at meals and around tables. But that's not even the end. If we go all the way to the book of Revelation, which is this apocalyptic description of how the end unfolds, chapter 3, verse 20, this is what Jesus says. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him and eat with him. Jesus could have said a whole lot of different things there, couldn't he? Maybe we would expect different things. Maybe we'd expect Jesus to say, if anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in and I will save him. If anybody hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in and we'll go to heaven. That's not what he says. He says, I will come in and I will eat with him and he with me. Seems like meals are really important in our story, yes? So it's fitting then that we're going to come to the table together today. In Paul's letters, he reflects on the Last Supper and on what it means, and he's trying to help us understand what is actually happening when the community of faith, the body of Christ, gathers together and we break the bread and we share the cup. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, he has a conversation about idolatry and he references back to the story of Israel at Mount Sinai and the golden calf, but then he says this. He says, the cup of blessing that we bless, is it not a participation in the blood of Christ? The bread that we break, is it not a participation in the body of Christ? Because there is one bread, we who are many are one body. For we all partake of the one bread. Two things there I want us to see. The idea of participation, and then the idea of unity. In Paul's letters, there are really two ways that Paul talks about what makes us one. What actually unites us as believers and makes us more than just a bunch of people sitting in a room together? What's different about this gathering than all other gatherings? He says it this way in Ephesians chapter 4. We ought to be eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. There is one body, and there is one Spirit. We believe that all who are baptized into the Christian faith are filled with the Spirit of God, this life-giving, life-transforming Spirit. And if the same Spirit that is in me, well, if it's the same Spirit in you, and in you, and in you, well, then we're all bound together, aren't we? We have unity in the Spirit, and we have unity in the body, because we're all sharing in this body of Christ. What does that mean? When Paul says that sharing the cup, sharing the bread, it's participation, like, what is he getting after? And I think what he's highlighting is the brilliance of Christ. I mean, this is one of those, like, beautiful, brilliant, and yet so simple things that Jesus does. How do we participate in somebody else's life, in somebody else's death, or in Jesus' case, his resurrection? What would that even mean? Well, remember what it is we're doing when we eat something. We're taking something outside of us that's not us, and it goes in, and it becomes us, and it becomes our life. Jesus understood that. So on the night that he was betrayed, he did not give us a theological treatise. He didn't give us some academic lecture on how all this works. He gave us a meal. He took bread and he said, "This is my body given for you." And he took the cup, he says, "This is my blood given for you." And we take the bread and we take the cup that Jesus says is his body and his blood, his sacrifice for us. We take it into ourselves, that he may become part of us, that he may become our very life. What does that mean for us? Well, if this is the table where we all become one in Christ, I would suggest we come ready for that unity. Or to say it a different way, this table becomes the reason for our reconciliation one to another. Because let's just be honest, unity is a lot easier to believe in than it is to practice. Living in community is really hard work. But if we're going to come to the table of forgiveness, where he forgives us, then we ought to forgive one another. If we're going to come to the table where we receive grace, I think we ought to be gracious one to another. But I will tell you this. As I've thought about this week, I continue to be convinced that God has given in the church exactly what a lost and dying world needs. I mean, look at the problems around us. We have a nation so deeply divided that has no place to find any unity, and we have a community that says, look, we're all different here and we're all the mess, but we can all be one in him. We have right here the unity the world desperately needs. What do we do with this? How do we begin to practice this in our lives? Are you just saying that we should come to communion a lot? Yeah, I'm saying that, yes. I get to communion as often as I can. As often as it is availed to me, I try and avail myself of it. We should do that. And just so you know, I don't know if this is common knowledge out there, this is a little bit of a side. If you ever need communion, if you're homebound, you're at the hospital, or you've been missing communion for whatever reason and you'd like to have it, you just pick up the phone and you call and you say, "Pastor, I've not had communion in a while. I need it. And I will bring it to you." That's how that works. You don't have to forego, just so you know. But do I mean anything more than that? I do. I would encourage us as we think about application, because we said the series is going to be practical, that we recognize the sacredness of meals apart from this table. Again, this is unique. You can't just do this anywhere. This is special. But other meals are special too. I would remind you that going all the way back to Abraham, the people of God have a long and deep tradition of the practice of hospitality. A practice that in a culture that is increasingly disconnected, it might be good for the church to reinvest in the practice. I think we actually need more people opening their homes, their tables, and by extension, their lives to people who are increasingly alone and isolated. I don't know if you caught this in the news. It wasn't a big deal. The Surgeon General released a report this week, a study that found that the long-term effects of loneliness are just as bad as long-term smoking. In terms of your health, one is just as bad as the other. Given that we're dealing with what has been called an epidemic of loneliness, that sounds like a pretty serious problem to me. What would it look like if we were the sort of people as Christians, as a community, that we said no to some really good things to create more margin in our lives so that we could practice really important things, things like hospitality? What if we were the sort of people that didn't have schedules that were wall to wall so that we could open up our lives to the lonely, to the broken? And I'm not just talking about eating with Christians. I like eating with you guys. You're nice people. Talking about our neighbors, talking about the lost, even strangers. What if we just radically lived out the values that we've had for century after century after century? It might change things, I think. Now, I will say this. As a community, I am very proud of you, in the best sense of that word, because as a community, we already lean into a lot of these things. So every time you get an email about a meal train because somebody needs meals, maybe they had a baby or lost a loved one, had to go to the hospital or they're sick, and you sign up to bring a meal, that's living out the values of our faith. That's good. Every time our church hosts a funeral meal, and even if you can't make the funeral, you make a salad and drop it off, you are leaning in to the hospitality values of our faith. Every time you go to the effort to make something for the coffee shop on Sunday morning so that the community of faith has a good excuse to rub shoulders, shake hands, swap stories, and do life together, well, thank you. You're leaning in to the hospitality values of our faith. There's a reason that after communion, we go to another set of tables. If I had to pick, it'd only be this, but if we can have multiple tables, it's good. Why? Because really important things in life happen around tables. Maybe we think through what it looks like to take our table in our home or the tables we visit and mark them out as sacred space. That at least in our heart we say, God, this belongs to you. Do with it what you will. How do we mark it out as sacred space? Well, if we remember that everything we have comes from God, including what's on the table, maybe we just always begin or end with a word of thanksgiving, blessing, praise. Maybe we establish rules in our home for what goes to the table. Maybe, and my wife's going to bust my chops for this later, we get serious about eliminating distractions at the table. Screens, devices, I'm guilty. I'm going to hear it later, I promise. But what if we made sacred space and gave it to God? as an expression of our confidence in him. And then let God do incredible things with our table. Something incredible is about to happen right now. Paul says, again in 1 Corinthians, that whenever we celebrate communion, we are proclaiming the Lord's death until he comes again. What does that mean? What are we proclaiming? What does his death mean? Victory. Evil. Death. Sin has been defeated. Christ reigns. The kingdom is at hand. And someday the king will return and all will be set right. And you and I live in a new age full of grace and power. I don't care what the news says. Jesus Christ is Lord and King. That is what we celebrate right now.